Well, welcome everyone. We start our first reading today, St. Basil of Caesarea, one of the so-called Cappadocian fathers, one of the Eastern fathers. There are these four great Eastern fathers, St. Athanasius, St. John Chrysostom, whose feast is today, St. Basil, St. Gregory Nazianzen. I guess I'd have to say five, St. Gregory of Nyssa. So in the Cappadocians are Nyssa, St. Basil, and then St. Gregory Nazianzen, because they're all from this one area in what's modern-day Turkey, Cappadocia. But there are these, St. John Chrysostom, we're going to be hearing a lot from later, because he has these homilies on Genesis. But we start with St. Basil, and we start with this work, the Hexameron, the work of the 6 days. Sometimes you can read modern things which talk as if people didn't realize the language of Genesis was symbolic or figurative, or as if nobody had like carefully gone through the text before. It's what Owen Barfield, who was a good friend of C.S. Lewis, called chronological snobbery. You always think things earlier than you are somehow dumber or less intelligent, and you in the modern era, you've kind of got the monopoly on careful reading or intelligence or whatever skill you're identifying. And there are two points that that we're drawing from St. Basil here. One is about the authorship of Genesis, and you could talk about it in terms of the whole Pentateuch, but at the least Genesis. And then second, we want to talk about just this opening line, just how much is going on in the opening line of God created heaven and earth. Okay? I'd like to start in a way to kind of situate the situation we're in when we pick up Genesis. This is an email that I got from one of our graduates who's in a Catholic university, whose name I will conceal to protect the guilty. I hope the school year is going well for you so far. I was wondering what the Catholic teaching is on the creation story and other stories in the Old Testament. I've been hearing people say that Catholics don't believe in the creation story or the story of Noah's Ark actually happened. This confused me, because I always thought that Catholics do believe these stories really did happen. And I have a distant memory of talking about this in moral theology. So it's great when you're 18, you can talk about things that happened 3 years before as a distant memory. but that's we operate in a milieu in which the Catholic world, many ordinary Catholics, don't really think there's anything factual going on in Genesis at all. That the crude way that my father used to put it, these are all just, you know, Jewish hillbillies who are just kind of making things up. And, you know, in our educated and reflective modern world, right, we know more. And the only way that we're going to preserve our faith, if we're going to be believing people, is that we really reduce all of this stuff at the beginning to legend and mythology. That's the only way that we're going to hold on to this thing, if we concede that there isn't some real genuine insight going on here at the start. So it really is a breath of fresh air when you pick up the church fathers, and these are people who think there's a real Moses and there are real Noahs and real Adam and Eve, and they take this as facts of faith. By the way, when I responded to it, I pointed out that in the Catechism, Adam and Eve are talked about as real historical people. The sin and the consequences of sin are talked about as real historical actions. Noah is talked about as a real person with a real flood, and that God made an everlasting covenant with Noah. So what we have very often in our church is this split between what we're taught catechetically and authoritatively, and our biblical establishment, our biblical academic establishment, which doesn't believe that at all. And in fact, when the Catechism came out, if you read the biblical establishment's assessment of the Catechism, these are scholars who say the Catechism is 100 years behind in Bible scholarship. It is totally out of touch with where Bible scholars are at. Some might look at that and consider that a problem with the Bible establishment, not actually with the catechism. When you read Saint Basil, notice how he talks about the selection of Moses. This is a certain kind of man with certain kind of moral habits who's led a certain kind of life. And the key thing is where he has this encounter with God, right? In the burning bush. And then further, that up on Mount Horeb, where he has this dialogue with God, where he receives the law. In other words, the reason that we're going to believe what we get in the Pentateuch is because this is a man chosen by God who had this direct encounter with God. Okay. Now, I mentioned last time, it starts with Hobbes, Thomas Hobbes, and the Leviathan, and Baruch Spinoza. These two figures of the Enlightenment, with Spinoza, the work is the theological political treatise. They're the ones who are the first to make the claim that what we call the Pentateuch was composed after the return from the exile. So in the time of Ezra, that's when all that stuff was written, long after the Exodus and Moses and all that. And I gave you this phrase in my introductory class, vaticinium exiventu, prophecy after the fact. So that what's happening is these people are composing this and creating a past that gives authority to the law. Okay? It's important to recognize that this theory or this hypothesis starts with two figures who are these Enlightenment writers who are basically, part of their project is destroying the authority of the Bible. That is part of their project. The denial of inspiration, the denial of miracles, that is all part of that early modern project. Hobbes is an atheist and a materialist. Spinoza is a pantheist, right? He thinks that God is sort of everywhere in everything. He doesn't believe in a God distinct from his creation, bringing it into existence. He denies all that. So that's where that comes from. Now, I had some conversations with folks after that first class, and they said, you know, there are a lot of people that I kind of like and respect, and they talk about Genesis being composed in this era. Couldn't you believe that and still believe that, like, it's coming from this original inspiration or original source? The devil's in the details. What you'd have to be thinking is, God appears to Moses. He gives him this fullness of revelation. Maybe it's not written down right away, but somehow across the centuries, it's preserved such that when these people are writing it down over here, they are writing down intact what it is that was originally given to Moses. That's what you would have to be maintaining. And most people who are following what they call the historical critical method, that is not what they are believing. They are really maintaining something like a vaticinium exiventu. That this is there was a real Moses and there was some kind of real Exodus, but all the stuff about miracles, all the stuff that's distinctively supernatural, maybe that happened and maybe it didn't. It's that the important thing for us is that we have this tradition, that we've inherited these stories, and somehow God is pulling that all together in some way in the time of Ezra. And what they miss when you put that out as a theory, what's the authority of it then? What's the authority of this revelation? You can't just have Ezra writing things down that aren't coming from some kind of intact tradition that goes back to Moses. Is this genuinely Mosaic or not? Okay. By the way, in the Catechism, it will say that the law came to the Hebrews from Moses. It will just teach that as a matter of fact. And what the Catechism is following is the statement of Dei Verbum. There are 16 documents that come out of the Second Vatican Ecumenical Council. Four of them are dogmatic documents. Dei Verbum is one of them. De Verbum, in other words, is an authoritative document. And it speaks matter-of-factly about the revelation of God coming to the chosen people through Moses. So, whatever it is you're signing up for, there has to be the idea that Moses is getting this revelation and it is being preserved intact way out to this point here where the exiles are returning from the Babylonian captivity. Okay, I think it's just easier on the brain that somehow it's written down in the time of Moses. I just think that's an easier thing to accept. But it's got to be from Moses. And that's among other reasons, that's why it is that when the magisterium, in this case, this was the Biblicum, the Bible Institute in Rome, at this point was an organ of the magisterium at the turn of the century. And it got this question, are Catholics free to deny that Moses is fundamentally the author of the Pentateuch? Okay, and the response was, no, you are not free to deny. You can come up with textual challenges in terms of, right, at the end of Numbers, Moses dies. Presumably Moses is not, and then I died, right? Presumably Moses is not doing that. But whatever is in there under sort of Moses' understanding or direction. Maybe a way of thinking about it, when we did Hebrews, remember, you can concede that St. Paul is not the author of Hebrews. It doesn't stylistically have the same earmarks that you would expect from St. Paul. But the substance of the teaching is very much St. Paul. So, are you free to believe that St. Paul was not able to write this down, but he gave it to somebody? He said, I need an epistle to the Hebrews, and it needs to say this, 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 this. So what this guy is writing down is substantially St. Paul, even if it's not St. Paul's, as it were, hand. Whatever is in the Pentateuch that's not Moses, what you would have to say as a guarantee of revelation, of inspiration, is that somehow it's under Moses' direction or understanding, right? He's going to somebody and saying, you need to complete the book. Complete the book with the following things, fill in what's missing. And he's trusting that that guy is going to follow the spirit of inspiration that he's given. So you could address it that way, but fundamentally it's got to be from him. I put down this term theophany because we have this special term to describe Moses' encounter at the burning bush. You know, who shall I say you are? When I go to the Hebrew people, who shall I say sent me? And he gets the voice, say, I am sent you. Say, I am sent you. Did that encounter happen or not? If this is somebody who has this direct encounter with God and is on the mountain of Sinai and receiving this, that's a reason to believe this guy. Right? Remember in Revelation, we can't just have vague traditions coming from who know who, right? It's important, for example, to the apostles that they were in the company of Jesus Christ, that they are relating what they saw and heard. Think of the first letter of John, which we had the Bible study on. Was that last year or year before? It's all a blur. Okay, last year. I have this distant memory of... this distant memory of this, the opening of that first letter, that which we have seen, that which we have heard, that which we have handled, right? Touched with our own hands, right? In other words, direct experience is important in religion. It's important for establishing authority, that you really are in a position to say what you're saying. That you really have been chosen by God such that we're going to believe you. We're not in a religion in which we can just have traditions come, as it were, collectively and anonymously, and somehow we're going to buy into it. If you want to talk about traditions and whatnot behind Homer, behind the Iliad or the Odyssey or the Aeneid, beautiful. Can we talk about all sorts of insights that there may be in the text as a result of that collective human experience? Great. But are we going to call the Iliad or the Odyssey or the Aeneid authoritative? No. And at the point where you are talking about the Pentateuch as if this is sort of just collective, anonymous legend, folklore, and we can draw spiritual lessons out of it. We can draw human lessons out of it. We can draw a new perspective of God out of it. You wouldn't get any authority out of that. And it's important that it's authoritative. Yeah, go ahead.
I'm going to be totally the devil's advocate, but how do you explain the whole discussion then of Adam and Eve, like pre-Exodus, prior to Moses' time? Because he is just writing then about...
No, God reveals to him the beginning. Yeah, all those things that you're getting in Genesis are God revealing to him, this is the way it was. Presumably, God is building on things that Moses already has, right? But if you look at, if you read apocryphal Hebrew literature, like the books of Enoch, or the books of Jubilees, or so on, these are books where you really are talking in some way about Jewish folklore or Jewish tradition. And something's got to be segregating out. This is genuine inspiration. This is something that may be next to it and may be worthy of belief. These are things that really are just made up. So whatever it is that Moses is getting, as it were, from his background, from his people, and from his culture, God has to be correcting that. You know, is it just Eve or is there Lilith? Right? In Hebrew folklore, there was this other woman that was created who didn't work out. Lilith. And, yep. Why do you think the feminists have a Lilith festival? That's what that goes back to. Okay? That's Hebrew folklore. But you're not going to say that's authoritative. And in the book of, you remember there's a moment in the letter of Jude where it talks about the devil disputing over the body of Moses. You know, that might in some way, and there are things about the devils in there that is this folklore or not? But evidently Jude or Peter, when they're using it, to make a point. They're, as it were, drawing on something that's commonly accepted from their people to make a point. But they aren't necessarily sanctioning whatever tradition or whatever story that they're dealing with. It's like in the Catholic world. Sometimes you'll have things that are, you know, legends of the saints. They're not authoritative. You know, they may be, some of them are worthy of belief, some of them are beyond belief. But, you know, they can be, as it were, part of the things that Catholics have as their tradition. Go ahead.
I don't know if this is an appropriate question, but when Moses received the Ten Commandments,
yes,
and they were hearing them,
yep,
so did they just think that was folklore? Because he physically had these Ten Commandments, right? I mean, how would...
Yeah, and from the historical critical point of view?
Yeah.
See, if you're all in with this historical critical point of view, you don't really believe that anybody back here can really be a monotheist. You're thinking all these people are polytheists, they're all pagans. These people finally developed, evolved socially and culturally to be monotheists. So when you say, well, don't they believe in like a reception? No, they're projecting back a monotheism that these people really couldn't have. When you're a historical critical scholar, you are thinking that there are these anthropological or cultural facts which then you need to approach the book and talk about, well, what's really believable and what's not. Is it really believable that people back here really had monotheism? No. So what they do is they invent a miraculous monotheistic past that is going to give authority to their present monotheism. Does that make sense? Some of these things I'm going to say to you, and you're just going to say, but at that point, you don't really believe anymore. At that point, you don't really believe anymore. But you have to, one of the things that we read with seniors, second semester, Rudolf Bultmann. Rudolf Bultmann is a Lutheran. He is one of the central figures of Bible scholarship in the first half of the 20th century. Bultmann denies inspiration. He denies miracles. He says, we have all grown up in an age of science. We've all grown up in an age of electricity and running water and radio. How are we really supposed to believe that people are possessed by devils? How are we really supposed to believe that people ascend to some kind of chair in the sky? How are we really supposed to believe that there's some crackle, crackle, sizzle, sizzle fire of hell and whatnot that's like at the center of the earth? And you may look at that and just say, this is so pernicious, this is so destructive. No, Bultmann is saying that because he's trying to be pastoral. We are asking people to believe things that are just impossible to believe. If we are going to have a real modern Christianity, we have to let all that stuff go. And what you end up having in its place is a kind of, it would be hard, it may sound harsh to say it, but almost like a socially relevant religion or a therapeutic religion or a relationship religion. We've got to have a religion which helps people make their way through life, gives them a sense of meaning and purpose, gives them some kind of consolation. But we're going to cut loose on all that supernatural stuff because you and I as modern people can't really believe that. And if we say we believe it, we're being dishonest. That's what Bultmann will say. Go ahead.
Maybe I'm not grasping this correctly, but if the Jews, the people, the Hebrews, weren't monotheists and weren't different, why would they have been enslaved in the first place?
Oh, because you could. I mean, if you can, whenever you can enslave people in the ancient world and early modern world, you did. But the idea would be that as slaves in Egypt, they basically believed what the Egyptians did. That was true. But then it would be that somehow when they got out of Egypt, how did they get out of Egypt? Oh, who knows? Anyway, once they got out of Egypt, they are essentially just as polytheistic as the Egyptians they left and as the Canaanites they are living among. And somehow there was some kind of development that allowed for monotheism in a history that we, you know, cannot track and don't have documentation of. But once the people get to the point where they really are monotheists, now they project that back. Okay. More to say. Let's move on to the created heaven and earth. One of the things that the section from the catechism that I quoted is from the section, it goes from about 281 to I think 287, and I just gave you two paragraphs of it. It's the catechesis on creation. And it's in terms of a short statement of how to read the creation accounts, it's very, very helpful. And one of the things that it points out is that when you read Genesis, of course, as people formed in science, anything that's about the start of the universe, it's like we're all thrown back to Carl Sagan and star stuff and animated planets swirling out of the sun and forming solar systems. That's the way we're formed to think about it. And so to counter that, we get this kind of warning, don't read Genesis as a scientific document or a scientific treatise. It's not like that. It's a different kind of thing. It's symbolic. It's figurative. Okay, but the problem when you tell people that is, if science is your only mode of factual or true statements, and you tell, especially our young people, this isn't scientific, now what you've told them is it's mythology. It's legend. There's no factual content. So what's the alternative to that? The alternative is you have to help the reader see, whether it's the teen reader or the adult reader, that there's a different set of questions that are a very important set of questions that are not scientific questions. So one of the things I have up here, Vatican II's document Nostra Aetate, is a good place to look. It's giving this kind of introduction to the questions that religions ask all over the world. The problems that weigh heavily on the hearts of men are the same today as in ages past. What is man? What is the meaning and purpose of life? What is upright behavior? What is sinful? Where does suffering originate? What end does it serve? How can genuine happiness be found? What happens in death? What is judgment? What reward follows death? What is the ultimate mystery beyond human explanation, which embraces our entire existence, from which we take our origin and to which we tend? That is the kind of question that Genesis is answering. How did we get here not in some kind of material, right, biochemical sense. Like, is there some kind of ultimate purpose and meaning to the universe? That is not the kind of question that science addresses or answers. And that's the thing that's helpful in what the Catechesis on Creation. It talks about how science answers how and when questions. So how did the universe develop? What kind of chemicals were there at the beginning? What kind of formation did it take over time? Was it 4 billion years or 10 billion years? Those are the kind of things that you know, astrophysics or cosmology, you know, scientific cosmology, that's what it's trying to answer. Genesis is all about, is there some ultimate reality beyond our universe? Is there some purpose to human life? Okay. When in the sciences, generally, science is not about meaning and purpose. If I go to the doc and I say, "Hey, I'm worried I have strep," he's going to take that foot-long Q-tip and like tickle the back of my throat and stir it in a petri dish. And if you get streptococci out of that, okay, well, you got strep. There's the news. But if I go to the doc and say, "Doc, if I'm healthy, will I be happy? Is health the highest good?" That is not something he's going to be able to stir something in a dish and look at it a week later. That is not an experimental, observational question. And what's going on at Genesis, right? There's, you know, I live in a universe in which there's good and there's evil. I live in a universe in which there's some kind of warfare between them. I recognize within myself that I'm wounded and pulled in one of these directions. I recognize, however, there are things in the universe that appear to be beautiful and good and appear to be there to help me out. How did it get this way? Right? That is not something that I am going to get from a scientific study. That is not what science is about. So when we tell people this isn't science, a better way of putting it, this is not answering the kind of questions that science asks. This is asking a different, it is answering a different set of questions. Where does the goodness in the universe come from? Why is there evil in the universe? How are they at war? What is my purpose as a human being? How do I fit in to this whole? Some of you, as you read the section on Basil, where he's talking about God created heaven and earth, he starts giving these alternate views. And there's even language in there about atoms and molecules. And you whoa. This, all of a sudden you feel as though, is St. Basil anticipating something modern, or is this just some kind of wild translation?
Somebody today wrote it and attributed it to him back then.
That is Simium ex philosopho or whatnot, or philosophers or scientists after the fact. The thing that you have to bear in mind is that when Basil is writing, he is responding to all these different views that are out there that come from a group of thinkers that we call the pre-Socratics. Okay, extra credit. Why do you think the pre-Socratics are called the pre-Socratics? Right? So these are these philosophers that flourished before Plato and his teacher Socrates. And most of them, not all of them, but most of them are materialists. So there's Thales. There we go. Thales is the one who thinks that all things come from water. Water is the ultimate element. Okay? And if you think about it, there's some sense to that. Water can get hard, and it can be liquid. It can have all these different states depending on the temperature. So can't you get everything out of... And think about organic life, all based on water. There's another thinker, Heraclitus. Heraclitus is the one who says that all things are fire. Fire is the ultimate element. And again, if you were to say all matter goes into energy and all matter comes from energy, that would sound very modern. Well, if you're looking for something out there that looks like it sort of embodies energy and you've kind of got just your ordinary experience, well, fire is a good candidate for that. There's one of the pre-Socratics, Empedocles. He thinks that there are four elements: earth, air, fire, and water, and then there are these forces out there love and hate. Love is what brings things together. Hate is what pushes them apart. Right? Can't you just hear the Beatles? All you need is love. Can't you just hear that in the background? Now, when we look at that, that looks, oh, come on, love and hate? That sounds so cheesy. What if we talked about it in terms that are used in modern chemistry? Attraction and repulsion. So there are four elements, and then there's attraction and repulsion. That would sound very modern. Wouldn't it be great? Think back to when you were in chem. Maybe in college, Chem 101. Wouldn't it be great to have a periodic table of four elements? Earth, air, fire, water. Oh my gosh, that final in chem would have been totally different. There were just four elements. And then let's put one more up here. Democritus. And Democritus is the one that's most relevant to what we're looking at. Democritus is the one that thought that everything was made of atoms. Atoma. Toma means to cut. A is the privative in Greek. So there are these uncuttable, unbreakable particles. Everything is made of these unbreakable particles. So they can be different in position or shape or arrangement. And that's why the world is the way it is. Okay? So in other words, in the ancient world, there are already people who are saying it's not God or the gods. What there is nature, and nature is made of some kind of stuff. And it's the kind of stuff that it's made from that makes things the way they are. Okay? So notice how Basil's response, God created heaven and earth. In other words, you're not just in a universe which is the way it is because of the stuff it's made from. That stuff has the order and arrangement that it does from some being that's the source and cause of it all. Okay? So it's a much more basic question to ask. You know, for the modern person, well, what's the stuff and how long was it cooking and when did it swirl and when did it do this and when did it do that? No, this is where did all that stuff come from, and what, to the extent there's sort of order in that, where does that order come from? So at the very beginning to say God created heaven and earth, it isn't just things emerging from matter. Okay? So one of the basic things that this is responding to is materialism. And by the way, if we were to look at this same era, this is the 5th century BC, if you look over at India, there are people who are starting to argue this in India. If you look over at China, same period, there are people who are doing this. This is a period that's called the Axial Age. There's a German writer called Jaspers. Looks like Jaspers, but those Y's, or those J's sound like Y's. Call Jaspers. And he talks about this just mysterious coincidence that around the world, people are starting to come to these same kind of insights where they're starting to just push away the mythology and starting to look at the natural world and explain things just in terms of nature. Okay? And what we're getting in Genesis is that, yeah, that it is important that material thing, is that matter isn't somehow bad or irrelevant. But all that stuff itself was brought into existence by a being that we call God. Okay. One of the things that when you read the prophets can be hard to track with is the way that they will make fun of idolatry. We have this view when we read these people, well, isn't it just that God revealed himself? And if you didn't know there was a God, wouldn't you be worshiping sticks and stones and statues and stars and whatnot? But that is not the way that the prophets talk. The prophets talk as if you really should know better. A text to look at for that, when you look at the Book of Wisdom, if you look at chapter 13, verses 1 to 5, you can look at that later. The author of Wisdom talks about how it is that when people take the sun or moon or stars to be God, and they look at the beauty of these things and they admire it, how much more beautiful, right, is the God who made them? How much better or higher is the God who made them? You ought to know that there's this being beyond the heaven and earth that somehow made it. But precisely because human beings have gone astray about this, God needs to reveal himself, not just in nature, but to pick out a group of people and give them the fullness of who he is, so that eventually this will be brought to the whole human race. So as you look at Basil talking about Genesis, notice how he talks about how it is that there are all these people out there that are in error about nature and they're in error about God. They think that nature is kind of self-sufficient or explains itself. And to the extent they think about the gods, they almost think about God, the God and the divine coming out of nature. My favorite example of this in Norse mythology, there's this god who's frozen in the ice, and this giant cow licks the god out of the ice. Okay, well, where did the god come from? Where did the cow come from? Nope, it's just there. But that's, in a way, that's the original tendency because, you know, these are all things that we can see. We can see matter. We can see earth and air and water and fire and so on. We can see those things. And so there's the tendency to reduce the world to the things that we can see. And part of what is going on in Genesis, by just the statement that God created heaven and earth, there is a reality above what you can see. What you can see is not it. Now, that may sound, oh, come on, don't all religions believe that? No! Look at Greek mythology. You can see Zeus and Apollo. Look at Norse mythology. You can see Odin and Thor. Look at Roman mythology. You can see Jupiter and Minerva and Venus. These are all beings you can see. And Genesis is bringing human beings back to a divine being that you cannot see. This is the real thing. This is the real God. You have got to rise above what it is you can see. I wrote down these folks as materialists, but in a way, all pagan religions are to some degree materialist. All pagan religions picture the natural world as being wrapped up with these beings that aren't clearly above the natural world. Remember in the Odyssey, like somebody, I think, is it Diomedes? He actually slices Aphrodite. Aphrodite is out there in the battlefield, somewhat foolishly. And he cuts her and she runs away crying. Right? Okay? You can hurt a god. Okay? There's something, on the one hand, absurd about that, but you can understand why people would have those kind of gods, because it's easy to get. They're easy to see. I suppose the corollary of this, if you've got a religion that's very easy to picture, that's a sign that it's false. If you've got a religion that's a little harder on the imagination and the intellect, that's probably a reason to think that it's true. It doesn't guarantee it's true, but it's more likely to be true if you've got something that's really beyond the human mind. Questions or things that came up in your reading of Basil that you want to... Yeah, go ahead, Mrs. McGinty.
I have a question.
So, yeah, you're right. So that is something that I think it's in the next reading we have, or it's in the reading with Augustine. Augustine will talk about the meaning of the word heaven and heavens. So even that word, that gets a kind of a whole treatment unto itself. But the quick way of putting it is, think about how it is that when we use the term heaven, sometimes we think of something in the sky. Sometimes we think of something that's spiritual, right? So how are those meanings related? And when we talk about God creating heaven and earth, are we thinking of him creating something spiritual? Are we thinking of him just creating something physical? And what St. Augustine will say is there are actually a number of meanings that are related that in fact are true. You are supposed to, out of that, with prayer and reflection and guidance, get that all of those things are happening. There are spiritual things happening, in other words, and there are physical things that are being described by that term. Yeah, excellent question. Go ahead.
We were talking about when
when Moses is the author, when would he have written things down? And was it written down, or was it orally passed on? Or what's the?
Remember, when you've got something that old, you can't have like the original parchments; those things to break apart. But I guess the tradition was that they were written down. Even if you want to say they're oral, they've got to be oral in ways in which they really are reliably oral. And if you think about the Iliad and the Odyssey, you can talk about those things being oral, but they get fixed the way they are once Homer wrote them down.
And when would he have written that?
Like toward the end of his life?
Okay.
They're wandering around in the desert for, remember how long? Plenty of time. This guy does not have a shortage of time to write things. Yeah, not too busy. Doesn't need a sabbatical. You know, like.
God supplied the pencil and the paper for him.
Yep.
Like, even that. Like, how did he write them down when they're out in the middle of the desert?
Don't know.
Yeah.
Dr. Bolt?
Well, one of the things that struck me in the reading that I'd never really thought that hard about before was St. Basil describing Moses' education that he would have raised among the Egyptians, and that he would have actually then, been taught to write and perhaps known something about turning this plant material into usable paper. And, you know, if they're really wandering far places, maybe they're not literally in physical desert 100% of the time. Maybe they are places where they encounter materials that can be picked up. Like, there's just so much we're not told.
Yep.
But that Moses would have had this Egyptian education and this training in the Egyptian religion, gods, creation stories, you know.
Yep.
He would have been given that from the beginning. He would not have been given his Hebrew traditional education from the beginning. And so for him to come after his experience with God to such a completely different place, but also have it to sort of, in his mind, get this revelation, and then
that's a very important point. That's a very important point.
Really struck me as important, yeah.
And that's something that St. Augustine will emphasize. That's something that when the Church Fathers will talk about Moses as a fitting recipient. This isn't just some guy. This is somebody who received the education that would have been, you know, fitting for that time, around for that time. It's like when you read Oswald Alice, when he talks about prophecy in the context of Isaiah. Don't think of God just picking somebody and saying, okay, well, gosh, I'll just have to make the best of this. No, God is picking somebody who's best able to understand what it is that he's giving. So if we talk about pens and paper, I mean, the most important thing is the author, that God has picked someone who's really going to get it. Okay, he's not just going to pick somebody at random. And so the preparation that Moses had puts him in the best position to what God is going to reveal at that point. Very good. Next week. See you next week. Thank you.